Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative conference call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments periodically throughout the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Amanda. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, the Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I would like to welcome you to today's call entitled Clubhouse of Suffolk, a Model Intervention for Tobacco Dependence in Individuals with Serious Mental Illness. This is the third in a series of calls that we have partnership with the Office of Mental Health on addressing tobacco dependence and recovery for persons with mental illness. If you were unable to participate in either the last two calls or have not downloaded the slides for today's presentation, and eventually all the call recordings are posted on the collaborative call site website of the New York State Smokers Quitline. That web address is nysmokefree.com. So from the website's front page, click on the Healthcare Provider and Partner tab, and then choose Collaborative Call. Click on the link for more information on the current and past calls, and you will find the presentation. Our featured speaker today is Tara Frederick, the Director of Special Projects at Clubhouse of Suffolk. Tara began her work at Clubhouse in 2004 as a clinical coordinator for the Smoking Cessation Project, and that was funded with a grant from the New York State Department of Health, and then she was promoted to her current position where she has assumed the responsibility for design of project curriculum, management of peer support services, individual treatment planning, tobacco policy development, and staff training. On today's call, Ms. Fredericks will discuss programmatic and non-programmatic strategies for addressing tobacco use in mental health settings. She'll also talk about the importance of recognizing consumers' desire and ability to quit tobacco use and how to identify resources to support effective tobacco dependence treatment. Before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We're pleased to offer KSAC continuing education hours for participating in this call. To fulfill that requirement of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Ms. Fredericks has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does she have any relationship with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. Please remember applications for credit will not be accepted after February 22nd. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Tara Fredericks. Tara?
Thank you, Anne, and thank everybody for having me on this call today. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to present to all of you a review of the problem that we're facing in addressing tobacco dependence in this population, as well as a description of the interventions that we've been successful in using, some of our results, and then a little direction on how you can get started in providing these services to the people that you're serving. If you're following along in the slideshow, I'm going to move right ahead to slide number 4, where it says a model intervention, because Anne has already reviewed the objectives for this presentation. So funding for the model intervention that I'm going to describe was originally provided by the New York State Bureau of Tobacco Use Prevention and Control, and Clubhouse of Suffolk is a nonprofit provider of psychiatric rehabilitation services and is a community day treatment setting. So I know that you've heard in previous presentations about the complexity of tobacco dependence, and I want to talk a little bit about how this applies specifically to individuals with serious mental illness. When we look at the addiction to cigarettes or to tobacco, we're looking at biophysiological, psychological, and behavioral components that we have to contend with. We all know that the addictive and psychoactive component of cigarettes is nicotine, and the neurochemical effects of nicotine addiction include withdrawal and the use of smoking for stress and symptom management. And when you're working with individuals in the mental health population, this becomes even more significant. When nicotine enters the brain and interacts with neurotransmitters, it can affect arousal, appetite, pleasure, mood, anxiety, and the reinforcing nature of nicotine as a stimulant and the fact that smokers, especially smokers with mental illness, dose so often or are smoking so continuously is one of the reasons why these individuals are so dependent on tobacco. And the reason that I want to review some of this information is before we get into discussing an actual intervention or model or services that we can provide, it's important that we as providers have an understanding of not only why this is important, but how this is going to roll out and what the issues that our smokers are going to face when they come to us for assistance. We all know that with addiction comes withdrawal. Many of you may be familiar with symptoms of nicotine withdrawal, especially if you or anyone close to you has ever tried to quit smoking or been successful in quitting smoking. What's significant in working with smokers with mental illness is how closely related the symptoms of nicotine withdrawal and the symptoms of the illness are. There are many similarities, and for individuals with mental illness, this can impact them in a couple of ways. Primarily, when someone tries to quit and they're not receiving adequate support and education and withdrawal management, quitting smoking can feel like decompensation or a recurrence of symptoms. And I'm sure if any of you have already begun your work in helping individuals with SMI to quit smoking, you may have come across this or a fear of this. Another factor in tobacco dependence is an individual's psychological attachment to cigarettes and to smoking. So individuals with mental illness, they often lack some basic stress management and coping skills, whether as a result of their illness or their life experience and institutionalization. Unfortunately, when we look at the biological or physical effects of tobacco use and cultural support of smoking within the mental health system, what we found is that a large number of smokers with mental illness have become so dependent on smoking that they actually lack all other coping skills. So they've had such ready access to a chemical and a behavior that works so consistently that they've been able to achieve that sense of calm or control whenever they need it without actually utilizing any healthy coping strategies. Often when our consumers try to quit smoking, they're able to realize that some of the stress that they felt throughout the day was not just alleviated by smoking, it was actually caused by it. But it's important to, when we're looking at implementing any services, to understand that stress management and symptom management are going to be skills that we have to teach. We also know that smoking is a tool for socialization, and again, this can be even more significant in a population where their opportunities for socialization may be lacking. I'm sure we can all think of an example when someone will use smoking as a way to initiate a social interaction, like asking a group of people if anyone has a light, or walking over and asking to bum a cigarette. But our population can use this a little bit differently as well. An example that I often use when I'm doing training is the individual sitting in a group session or sitting one-on-one with you, and a topic comes up that they're uncomfortable with, so they excuse themselves to have a smoke break. Unfortunately, the use of tobacco to initiate and to avoid interaction has been supported or at least allowed in most mental health settings. So we know that smoking has a strong history in the mental health system, and this is one of the barriers that when we are looking to implement services that we're going to have to acknowledge and we're going to have to overcome. If we look back less than 30 years, psychiatrists were smoking with their patients during therapy, nurses and social workers were distributing state cigarettes on the psychiatric wards, smoking was encouraged as a tool for self-control, and the use of cigarettes to reward someone for medication compliance or for doing their chores or to help somebody relax when they became agitated, it was a supported practice. So now we're at a place where we understand the implications and consequences of tobacco use, and the health and mental health system is making movement towards change. And while this change is good, we can't ignore the history because, unfortunately, for a lot of the people that we're going to be working with and a lot of the people who are highly dependent on tobacco, this is the life experience that they've had. So all of that sounds really dreary and dismal, but there's hope. Although few people are successful without treatment, research indicates that roughly 70% of smokers want to quit, and we know that there are treatments that will increase the individual's likelihood of success, the use of nicotine replacement therapy or other psychotropic medications can actually double a person's chance of having a successful quit attempt. And when you add behavioral therapy and support, the likelihood of success can increase exponentially. And so what I'm going to talk about today, if you want to go to the next slide, is an intervention that encompasses all of these support services, that acknowledges the history and the complications of smoking within this population, and gives providers the tools and the knowledge necessary to assist individuals in making this change in their lives. So when Clubhouse was originally awarded funding back in 2003, it was to develop a model for tobacco dependence treatment. For those of you who are following along, I'm on slide 5 now. This funding actually came after the loss of several members or clients of Clubhouse to tobacco-caused diseases. Our executive director realized that although we had been providing exemplary psychiatric services, we had completely overlooked the medical health issues that so many of our members were facing. And at the time that the program began, roughly 60% of our members or our clients and about 25 to 30% of our staff were current smokers. But the community was in a place where we were, as a whole, looking for help and looking for change. And when you're beginning to roll out any kind of services, the first thing that you really need to do is to assess your agencies and your staffs and your community's level of readiness for change. And so I utilize here the stages of change wheel so that you can see this is a tool that we use with clients when we're assisting them in making a quit attempt or preparing for a quit attempt. But we really need to utilize this model to assess our own readiness to implement these kind of changes. The next slide. The project developed a multi-tiered approach to treating tobacco dependence within the Clubhouse model, which was outpatient, for us, was the outpatient psychiatric rehabilitation day model, day program. The intervention included staff development and training, individual treatment sessions with trained mental health providers. We ran an 8-week psychoeducational tobacco awareness group to address preparation for smoking cessation, engagement, and skill development. We also offered peer support groups to assist in relapse prevention and readiness development. As part of all individual and group interventions, we encouraged our consumers or our members to discuss tobacco dependence, to discuss tobacco treatment medications with their healthcare providers or their psychiatrists. We provided basic education, including how the different medications worked and how to use them properly once they were prescribed. As part of our tobacco awareness groups, we utilized Healthy Steps, which allowed our consumers to participate without making a commitment to quit. And this helped to build self-efficacy and develop skills in preparation for future quit attempts. Next slide. I was at a conference recently, and I attended a workshop on the integration of wellness services into mental health treatment settings, and a consumer who was a co-presenter responded to a question from the audience, and the response, I believe, was a great summary of why we need to integrate services, and by integration, I mean why we need to provide tobacco dependence treatment services within the mental health treatment setting. And the co-presenter said, there are many arguments for the integration of services. Clubhouse values can point out a couple relationships are key. If we ask someone to make a significant change in their lifestyle, we may be more successful in motivating and helping them if we know them and if we have a therapeutic relationship with them. Access is an issue around many services. Unfortunately, tobacco dependence treatment is not funded at a level that allows everyone to access all of the services that they may need. When you add to that transportation issues, financial difficulties, multiple appointments for psychiatrists, therapists, et cetera, symptoms, accessing services for the people that we're serving can be nearly impossible. Language and expertise speak to the same issue. Mental health and psychiatric rehabilitation have an existing language and existing community and culture that our members, our consumers, already understand. And when we're able to put tobacco dependence treatment services into these same terms, then our members or consumers may be able to grasp the information and utilize the skills that they've already developed in their recovery. And then culture. This speaks to not only the impact that culture can have on a service, whether it's accepted, utilized, et cetera, but on the impact that a service can have on our culture. So our mental health treatment settings and our mental health treatment culture. When we made tobacco dependence treatment something that happened at Clubhouse and something that was part of how we addressed recovery with our members, we sent the message that this is a part of health and mental health. The next slide talks about some of the specific services that we provided. As I said, the project was multi-tiered, and We provided services to members who were at every stage of change. And I know that during the last presentation, you had a chance to learn about Dr. Williams' Learning About Healthy Living model. And we incorporated a lot of those tools in our original address to the community. So we talked about wellness in general, and we incorporated tobacco into that. We talked about making changes in general and talked about incorporating quitting smoking into that. Our primary psychoeducational service was a group that we titled Why I Smoke. And we titled it that so that it could really draw in people who weren't necessarily even considering making a quit attempt or weren't even sure that they wanted to engage in services, but they would be willing to come and learn about their smoking or talk about their smoking as long as it was non-confrontational. In addition to that group, we also did individual services, as I mentioned before, development, readiness development, and personal quit planning. We also then ran cessation and relapse prevention groups for individuals who had graduated to the point where they were in the preparation or action stage of readiness, and they were really ready to develop their quit plan and make a quit attempt, and we allowed them to do that in a cohort if they didn't want to just work individually with one of our staff. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific services that you can roll out, and when we open up for questions and answers, you can feel free to ask me about any of these. Next slide. The tobacco awareness group, or the Why I Smoke group, utilized a reduction to quit method, which allowed our members to access services, again, at any stage of readiness. So it removed the pressure of having to commit to change and to set a quit date, and it allowed them to build their self-efficacy by partializing the task of quitting and helping them to experience success. And one of the tools that we used was the Healthy Steps calendar. And reflecting back on the information that I reviewed about how dependence is so significant in this population, what we did in addition to providing information about smoking and about nicotine and about tobacco treatment medications and about how to quit is we looked at what other skills did they need to build or what behaviors did they need to change or implement so that when they reduced the number of cigarettes that they were smoking, they could be successful in maintaining that. So we knew that they were using cigarettes as a significant stress management or symptom management or socialization tool. And so if we were going to ask them to take that away, we looked specifically at what skills or what behaviors we needed to build so that they could replace that cigarette with something more healthy. And the healthy strategies that will come to most people's minds or most providers' minds is, oh, well, you know, eating healthy, drinking water, getting exercise, talking with friends. And all of those seem very basic and very simple and very effective, and they are. But what we found is that a lot of our members or consumers weren't even necessarily ready to implement those, or they didn't know how to. They didn't know how to reach out to a friend and say, let's do something other than smoke together. They didn't know how to exercise or be consistent with exercise, or they lacked motivation. They didn't know how to eat nutritiously, or they didn't have access to nutritious foods, or they, you know, felt unmotivated to implement that behavior. So a lot of times it was really breaking it down to basic skills like recognizing stress, doing deep breathing, taking a shower, things that they could access and that they could already utilize. Next slide. So the way that we implemented changes was through staff development and training, policy, marketing and awareness, and then implementing what we called talking about tobacco. So these were community changes. When we rolled out the program, and I would encourage anyone who's looking at rolling out a program, you have to look at this from multiple levels. You have a lot of stakeholders in this, and with each stakeholder group, there's the potential for resistance. And so we wanted to make sure that we were addressing everybody from our staff, our clinicians, our members, our consumers, visitors, family members. And so the services were directed obviously at our consumers, but then we also had to make changes within our community, within the setting that we were looking for these services to exist within. So we did a lot of staff development, a lot of training. We looked at our policy. We were not ready to become a smoke-free facility. And so we looked at a more gradual change in our policy so that we could protect the rights of non-smokers, give people who were making a quit attempt the opportunity to have outside areas where it was smoke-free. But we didn't go right to a smoke-free community. So we started with a smoking area and removing smoking from all of the entrances, and there were gradual changes. We did a lot of marketing and awareness, and I'll talk about some of the specific strategies for that, and then we did talking about tobacco. And talking about tobacco essentially was asking all of our staff to begin to integrate brief interventions into the treatment that they were already providing. And I'm certain that many of you have been trained on brief interventions or the abbreviated version of ask, advise, and refer. And what we found was that when we asked our staff to just have conversations about smoking, or when they were teaching a class on budgeting to make sure that they mentioned, you know, smoking as a line item, you know, if a consumer was a smoker, well, how much do you spend on cigarettes, and including that in their budget. When they were talking about eating healthy, talking about making sure that you address all of the things that you're putting into your body. When they were talking about exercising, that they would talk about, you know, increasing your stamina by quitting smoking. When they were teaching a stress reduction class, that they were talking about, you know, removing cigarettes and discussing the stress that could be caused actually by smoking and then going into withdrawal and then smoking. And so really just inviting our staff to participate in this. And we provided them training so that they were prepared to do that. But it was really significant. So on the next slide, I'll begin to tell you a little bit about some of the outcomes that we had from this original set of interventions. So our first outcome was that in addition to the members who participated directly in our services, we found that other members were quitting or making quit attempts or cutting down significantly. we found that there was a lot of support and outreach by our members and by our staff, and we found that this program could be replicated. So next slide. In addition to the measured effects that I'll tell you a little bit about, we also saw change in tobacco use culture at Clubhouse, which resulted in, as I said, additional consumers decreasing their smoking, making quit attempts. Consumers who were able to quit acted as role models for those who were still smoking. They modeled participation in groups, acted as mentors. They modeled the use of NRTs, which we always included, invited them to use during any of our groups, so that other members could see this was an appropriate tool for them to be using as part of their overall recovery. And they also modeled success in changing their own behavior. And fortunately, we had some staff who were also developed their readiness to make a quit attempt during the time when we were rolling this out and were able to act as role models and share their experience of, you know, trying to make a quit attempt and ultimately being successful with our members, which was very powerful. Next slide. So here are some of our results. Of the members who participated in the tobacco awareness groups or the Why I Smoke groups, 36% made a serious quit attempt and nearly 24% maintained their quit time for at least 3 months. We measured a serious quit attempt as no smoking for a minimum of 24 hours. It was self-reported on a weekly basis, and this number has increased, obviously, since data collection was discontinued. We also saw, as the slide says, a significant decrease in number of cigarettes smoked per day among those who made a quit attempt and those who never got to making a quit attempt. They were just cutting down. So an example is one consumer cut down significantly over a few months, then made a quit attempt, and she was successful in not smoking for about a week, but she never returned to her original rate of smoking, which was 2 packs a day. So she was able to get down to about 15 cigarettes a day, and while we were collecting data, you know, she was able to be smoke-free for about a week. She couldn't maintain that, but she maintained the 15 cigarettes a day, which was very significant. We also looked at the use of NRTs, and what we found that using a tobacco treatment medication was associated with a larger decrease in the number of cigarettes smoked. So, again, those who were using a tobacco treatment medication were able to cut down more than those who were not. The next slide shows that participation in the group was correlated with a decrease in cigarettes smoked per day, and we found the rate was the same for males and females. However, males in our study started at a higher rate of consumption, so they started off smoking more. That's why the lines are separated on the slide. And then the next slide shows that of the people who made a quit attempt, 72% used nicotine replacement therapy. And we provided education and support in accessing nicotine replacement therapy and other pharmacology. And we really encouraged our members to have an open dialogue with their psychiatrists or their primary care physicians, whoever was prescribing for them, because, as I stated earlier, withdrawal is really significant for this population. Their level of dependence is often higher, so the withdrawal can be more significant, but it's also very reminiscent of symptoms or can make them feel like they're experiencing symptoms, or if it's not managed properly, can really increase their anxiety or their depression and can make it so that they're less successful in quitting smoking. So we were not surprised to see that many of our people who made a quit attempt were using NRT, and we were very pleased to see that. The next slide just gives a few outcomes from another replication study that we did with the Urban Institute for Behavioral Health. We worked with 6 program sites, and They had a total of 111 consumers engaged in group services. All of this data was collected through the group services. But essentially, we did training with about 25 of their providers to train them on tobacco, tobacco dependence, tobacco and mental health, and then all of the services that were involved in this model so that they could roll them out at their agencies. And they found great success in doing that, and it also taught us a lot about the model and about its implications within the mental health setting so that we can be more helpful to future partners in identifying barriers and helping to overcome them. And also we did a lot of work with these agencies to assess their readiness for change and do some readiness development work with them before they actually rolled out the services. Okay. So on the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our observations over implementing all of these strategies and implementing these services and kind of what we've found over the years. As I mentioned, culture plays a large part in an individual's dependence on tobacco. And when we look at the mental health system, there are some common thoughts, beliefs, or fears that we've found among all of the treatment providers that we've worked with. And we mention these here because we feel that it's important to understand that the work of tobacco dependence treatment in individuals with serious mental illness is work that, as mental health treatment providers, we have to do. And we have to understand and change our beliefs and attitudes about tobacco use so that we can provide these services to our clients. What we found is that there's a general lack of awareness or knowledge regarding tobacco, tobacco dependence as a whole, and the relationship of tobacco and mental health that I touched on just briefly at the beginning of this presentation. On slide 20, it shows some of the data that we collected from staff. Specifically, what we found is that there's a lack of awareness of available resources, such as the New York State Smokers Quit Line. There's a lack of knowledge that talking about tobacco or providing brief interventions to consumers has been proven to move them towards change. Additionally, there are many misconceptions about tobacco, cigarettes, and nicotine. And what we found is that less than half of staff who were interviewed, which included paraprofessional, professional staff, clinical staff, and nurses, so less than half of them knew that nicotine was not a carcinogen. And so we found that this is significant, and this is something that you have to make sure that you bring up to staff, because if you believe that nicotine is a carcinogen, it's going to impact your willingness or your ability to promote or to support the use of NRT or the information that you're going to be providing consumers about NRT, which is a tool that we know is significant in helping them to quit smoking. The next slide. We found that tobacco dependence treatment needs to be a priority, and it needs to be integrated into psychiatric rehabilitation. What the statistics on the next slide show us is that staff that we worked with, that we interviewed, recognized the importance of quitting smoking to improve an individual's physical health and their mental health. However, there's room for progress. So regardless of importance, over half of the staff interviewed did not believe that consumers they served could quit smoking. And so this was an attitudinal change that we needed to address, and that likely all of you who are looking to implement smoking cessation services or tobacco dependence treatment services, you're going to have to address this. I don't know that all of the staff that were interviewed or surveyed would have necessarily admitted this to each other or admitted this to their supervisor, but it was a fear that they held, that we're going to provide all of these services, and no matter what we do, our consumers are not going to be able to quit. And one of the greatest ways that we found to overcome this fear or this attitude was to have our consumers share their stories about quitting smoking, or even about the process, even if they weren't quit or if they had relapsed back. So in moving forward, just consider and keep in mind that your consumers can be one of your greatest tools in helping your culture and helping your community to make these changes. Another observation that we made is that there's a lack of awareness and knowledge regarding tobacco dependence in this population among professionals and service providers. It's evident that in order for consumers to achieve long-term success in quitting smoking, we need to provide support and services across a continuum of care. So it's not enough that an individual will be smoke-free while on an inpatient psych unit and then discharged to a day hospital and encouraged with smoke breaks. It's not enough that an individual will receive support to stop smoking at their day program and then go home to a community residence where everyone smokes and there's no one to support them. And it's not enough that a consumer will be motivated and empowered through his housing case manager to try and quit and be deterred by his psychiatrist who doesn't want to prescribe tobacco treatment medications. All levels of the mental health system and all mental health treatment providers have to have basic awareness and knowledge about this issue, and they have to have the ability and the willingness to provide support in order for this to ultimately be successful and in order for consumers to ultimately be successful. So the next slide shows us that mental health providers believe that having the ability to provide knowledge and support will help to motivate the individuals they serve to make a change. So believe that our clients would want to make change if they were given the right support. They believe that consumers would want to make change with their smoking if they were given information. And so the key was really finding out how can we filter this information, how can we provide this information that we have, that your cessation centers have, that the New York State Smokers Quit Line has, that some of the professionals in the field have. How can we get it from their heads into the heads of your providers and your agency and then to the table with the consumer so that they can have this information, so that they can increase their motivation to make change, and then how can we support it once they're motivated? So I began talking a little bit about some of the programmatic changes that we implemented, and I want to talk also about the non-programmatic strategies and steps that everyone can begin to use and can actually begin to use today. We believe that introducing tobacco to the mental health treatment setting through discussion, sharing of knowledge, and awareness of resources is a great first step. However, we also know from experience that a comprehensive integrated program is necessary for sustainable change. So if you are at the level of readiness where you are ready to start talking about this and you're ready to start sharing knowledge with your staff and with your consumers and making sure that you have links to resources that people can use, that's a great place to be starting, and that's a great tool to be using. But it's also important to kind of be looking ahead to the future that in order to really make changes within the mental health culture and in order to really sustain the changes that we're asking our consumers to make, we're going to have to implement comprehensive treatment services for them. And these services are going to include staff training, education, individual or personalized services, tobacco treatment medications, peer support, and policy. So So the tobacco, the Healthy Body, Healthy Mind model on slide 25, again, outlines the services or the treatment model that we had developed. But many of you might be thinking, as it demonstrates on slide 26, you know, where do we go from here? Most of you probably know that the mental health system has historically been a safe haven for tobacco, that the cultural impact, that the high rates of nicotine addiction and use of cigarettes and self-medicating effects of smoking has had an impact on our community and on our services. But again, as I stated before, change is possible. We cannot expect a culture shift to happen overnight, but there are steps that we can start to that we can take today to start the process. And I want to share a couple of the strategies that we used as non-programmatic changes. And I will talk a little bit at the end of this presentation about what we're currently doing programmatically and through PRO services specifically. But I want to make sure that I present some of these non-programmatic strategies because all of you could really start them today. So one of the things that you could do is take some of the materials that we talked about today, some of the statistics, some of the data that you've heard in the previous presentations, or order a poster or some flyers from the New York State Smokers Quitline and hang them in prominent places in your agency. We hung posters in our bathrooms because you have a captive audience. They're looking for something interesting to read, so we gave it to them. You could talk. We asked each of our staff that we provided training to and each of the staff in our agency to, before the end of each day, have at least one conversation with at least one consumer about tobacco. And we said you can talk about anything, about how it impacts their health, their housing, their finances, their job, their recovery. If they come in, you know, it's the flu season, bronchitis season. If they come in and it's the third time they've had bronchitis this season, take the opportunity to just give them some information or just pull their smoking into the conversation. This could also be done by adding a question about tobacco use to your intake, or congratulating somebody that you know has been working on cutting down or who's made a quit attempt. We also encourage people to share, to use the information that you learned today or in the previous presentations or any of the resources that you've been told about and present them to the other staff in your agency. So already you have kind of self-identified as leaders within your agency if you're sitting in on these conference calls and these webinars. So now your role becomes not only increasing your own knowledge and skills, but also sharing this information and beginning this culture change. We've had an overwhelmingly positive response to our video. It's called Smoke Alarm, and it's a great tool to begin the discussion of tobacco with your staff or with your consumers. There's a clip that's up on our website, theclubhouseofsuffolk.org, and you can also order the video right through there. And if you print out the order form and write that you are on this webinar, I can make sure that they send you a free copy. So we really want to encourage everybody to utilize this as a tool for your agency, because the video, it doesn't talk about our program, it doesn't talk about it talks about Clubhouse of Suffolk, but it's really a presentation of our consumers who were going through this process with us and making these changes in their own life. And that's why it's powerful, because it really just gives them the forum to discuss how tobacco and how smoking is significant in their lives and what supports they need to make change and how change is possible and what change means in their life. And it's been a great tool. So some general steps to success or to getting started with this whole process. I would encourage you to evaluate your agency. You need to look at knowledge of your staff, attitudes, stage of readiness for change. I believe that my contact information was provided either through these slides, or if not, I'm sure that Anne can make it available to you. We have tools that can help you to assess this, to assess knowledge and attitudes of your staff, as well as your community or your consumers. But really get a feel. Your first step is really going to be to determine where are you, where's your starting point, what do you need to do, and then provide staff training. So take the information that you're learning on these webinars and bring them to a staff meeting, or access some of the training that's available online or available through Clubhouse and integrate it into your staff training. Start with consciousness-raising activities, so have a wellness initiative, or start rolling out the learning about healthy living, or have a wellness day or a wellness fair, and make sure that you're discussing tobacco as part of that. Then implement your services, so then roll out your talking about tobacco groups or the learning about healthy living groups or the individual services with one of your staff who's been trained on tobacco and tobacco-dependent treatment. And then reevaluate and implement policy change. And if you follow those steps, then likely the services that you integrate are going to meet the needs of your community the best. So that's the end of the slides, but I want to tell you a little bit about where Clubhouse of Suffolk stands now with our tobacco dependence treatment services. In 2007, we actually transitioned into a PROS, which I'm guessing that most of you on the call are from PROS agencies. So with that transition, we had to figure out a way to make sure that the services that we were providing were applicable to our PROS license, were meeting the needs and the objectives of our members' IRPs and their service plans. And so what we were able to do is, first of all, we worked with OMH, who was fantastic in making sure that nicotine dependence was on the formulary. It was something that you can provide services for through IDDT or the dual disorder treatment. And then we also provide smoking cessation services through our wellness self-management services. So in addition to incorporating discussions about tobacco into any wellness or health or financial budgeting, symptom management, any of those classes that we do, it's integrated. But we're also able to run our Why I Smoke group as a wellness self-management group. We provide individual services around tobacco dependence treatment through wellness self-management or through BLST, basic living skills training, depending on what we're working on with the individual. So if the individual has a work goal and they've identified that smoking or their smoking is one of the barriers that they're facing in getting a job, either because they run out of money to have transportation to interviews, or they're afraid that their clothes or their hair smells like smoke, or they don't think that they would have enough stamina to stay on the job because of the health consequences of smoking, or they have to take too many breaks, and they're looking at quitting smoking. Wellness self-management could be around, well, how do you better manage your symptoms? How do you develop your readiness? How do you use quitting smoking as a tool to help you achieve this goal? BLST could be the basic living skills training. Those services could really be centered around building the other skills that they need. So maybe in order to quit smoking, they really need to be implementing healthy eating and exercising or general stress management skills or time management or budgeting skills. And so we take the integration of tobacco dependence treatment very seriously, and we make sure that for all of our consumers who are smokers, who are thinking about quitting smoking, that it's incorporated into their plan, that we help them to identify how it might be a barrier Or we make sure that we're looking at what skills could they be building now in working on their other goals that they're motivated to work on that will also assist them when they're ready to quit. We don't pressure anybody to make a quit attempt or even to engage in services. We just make sure that we are prepared to provide them with support and knowledge and whatever they need when they're ready to take that opportunity. We also are able, all of our PROS agencies are able to offer smoking cessation or tobacco dependence treatment services as an IDDT service. For this service, as with any IDDT service, the individual has to be enrolled in your clinic, and then they have to have IDDT services on their IRP. And we have had limited success with having people kind of sign up to or want to participate in IDDT services for smoking cessation, and we rarely had a large enough cohort to run an IDDT group, so most of this is individual services, but it's definitely an option, and depending on the percentage of your clients that are enrolled in your clinic or how involved your clinic staff want to be, that's a great resource to be able to use, and it's a great way to involve the clinic staff in providing and supporting members in quitting. And the biggest strategy or the biggest service that we utilize is our peer support services. So all of our peer support staff are trained on tobacco dependence treatment, and they have a little manual that they can use, which is really just discussion topics and general information and facts that they can, you know, share and give to people, and they utilize their own recovery stories if they're a former smoker or another change that they've made in their life. And they provide peer support services around smoking, both individual and group. And we actually run a peer support group for quitting smoking or for our smokers twice a week. And it's one of our best attended groups that we have at Clubhouse of Suffolk. So it says a lot about, you know, developing that readiness. Some of our clients, they might not be ready to come to a group with me, you know, talking about tobacco or with another staff member. They might not be ready to sit down individually and talk with a staff member, but they might be willing to go to that group. Or they might be meeting with somebody individually and they just want to be able to talk about it with their peers and gain some extra support. So that's a very powerful tool that we're very fortunate to be able to use. So I think we have just a few minutes left, and before we move into questions and answers, I would actually like to turn it over to Pat Vax to talk a little bit about the New York State Smokers Quit Line.
Thank you so much, Tara, for your outstanding presentation and for the time that you spent with us sharing your knowledge and your expertise. And thank you to our returning participants on the call today. And I want to, on behalf of our collaborative call work group, welcome anyone who is new to our collaborative call series. We do look forward to having you join us. Now that we've completed, this is the final of our three-part series with mental health and behavioral health. So we do encourage you to join us for our future calls, and we want you to also share this information with your colleagues so they can also learn more about tobacco, and especially around chronic diseases and clinical applications and implementing the clinical practice guideline. The Quit Line is a free and confidential evidence-based cessation program. We provide services to help all New York State residents become and stay tobacco-free. And we provide free motivational coaching. And Tara mentioned throughout her presentation talking about the tailored services and interventions. And that's one of the things that our coaches are well trained to do is really tailor the information to help someone who is struggling with trying to quit and to maintain their ability to stay tobacco-free. We do provide a two-week starter kit of patches, and we offer downloadable fact sheets. They're right on our website at nysmokefree.com. And materials such as break loose guides. We have a pocket guide in larger versions, and we also have them in Spanish. And we have an online smoke-free community and so much more that we encourage you to explore on our website and learn about the tools, the free tools that are really available to you to help your patients and your clients become smoke-free. And as a clinician or a referrer to the Quitline, you can either provide the Quitline number at 1-866-NY-QUITS, that's 1-866-697-8487. You can provide that number to your client or patient, or you can give them the website as well at NYSmokeFree. You can also refer a client or a patient by using our fax referral system, and we also have a password-protected online referral system that you can learn more about under the Health Provider tab on our website. We do encourage you to call us directly to learn more about our services, and you will receive some help from one of our QUIT coaches. And we, as I said, I encourage you to ask any questions that you have, and they'll be happy to help. Please remember to include the QUIT line as one of your interventions or one of your strategies during your treatment planning with your clients, and we're ready to help. So please make sure you contact us, and we encourage you to use our services. They're there for all New York State residents to help them become tobacco-free. So at this time, I want to thank you again, Tara, and we're going to turn it back to Amanda, and we will be opening it up for questions and answers.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Our first question is from Rosebald Beville. Rosebald, state your question.
I have a question. Would it be possible to do two groups for smoke cessation? Because right now I'm doing an IR group. Would that be possible to do a group for WSM, which is Wellness Self-Management Group for smoking?
Yeah, we actually encourage you to work to identify which members are most appropriate. An IR group is really going to be for members who are actively trying to make a quit attempt. That's what we've used it for. It's for members who are actively involved in the quit attempt process. So that would be really our quitting group, which we use a different curriculum. Our wellness self-management group, we run almost continuously. So we change our classes or our groups that are offered every 3 months.
Yes.
But we keep the Why I Smoke group on there pretty frequently, as long as we have, you know, some interest in it. And that's really for members who are just exploring that, you know, their readiness to quit smoking. And some of them will come in and they'll, you know, attend a couple of groups and learn a little bit about it and be like, okay, now I'm ready. But a lot of people will kind of hang out there for a while and really be exploring it or, you know, developing that readiness over many months. So
yes,
I would definitely encourage you. Again, we tried to keep our quitting smoking group as one where it was modeled after groups that are held in the community, where it was really about setting a quit date as a group and going through the process of quitting in that early relapse prevention together as a cohort. And then our other group was for members who weren't at that level of readiness yet. So I would say yes. If you have staff and members, you know, willing to participate, I would absolutely run it.
Yeah, thank you. One more. Would I be able to get a certificate at the end of the training?
A certificate?
Yeah.
Well, our training we do. We don't do credentialing, mm-hmm. but in New York State currently,
yeah.
Even the Certified Tobacco Dependence Treatment Specialist isn't, we don't actually have that in New York State yet, and it's not a national certification.
Okay.
So right now, as far as my understanding is through our license, is you just have to have training in order to be providing these services.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's fabulous.
That helps, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from Michelle Ferrande. Michelle, please state your question or comment.
Hi, good afternoon. I just was asking about the smoke alarm video. That video is primarily for the staff, or can that be shown as to the clients as well? Thank you.
The smoke alarm video is really appropriate for anybody. We developed some frequently asked questions that are meant to help you to develop conversation around it, and there's different ones that can be applied whether you're showing it to a consumer group or a staff group or a mixed group. So we've used it in both ways. When we first developed it, we showed it at staff meetings and talked about, okay, so now we have this information and we have these stories and what are we prepared to do, and or even it's just a great way to present some of the basic information to your staff. But we found it to be extremely powerful with consumers. So we've shown it at community meetings. We've shown it at many conferences. And we actually also utilize it as part of our Why I Smoke group, so that if we don't have the opportunity to actually invite in members who have gone through the group and who have made a successful quit attempt, then we're able to use the video to kind of showcase some of their stories.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
One of the questions that I'm asked frequently when I do training is how to overcome resistance from staff, and most frequently this resistance is from staff who are smokers, and so this will kind of touch on the issue of policy as well as practice. And I think it's important to for any agency who's looking at rolling out these services to acknowledge that you're likely going to have some staff who are not ready to make this change, and many or some staff who are current smokers themselves who might be thinking, like, how am I going to, you know, be telling our members to quit smoking, our clients to quit smoking? How am I going to be encouraging this when I smoke myself? Or I find it hard enough to quit. I don't really think they're going to be able to make this change. And often the example that I'll use is most of us feel comfortable talking about the importance of healthy nutrition. We know that it's important to talk about, you know, eating whole grains and fruits and vegetables and drinking lots of water. And while it might not be our preference to teach a group on nutrition, if we were dealing with somebody who was diagnosed with diabetes, we would likely be comfortable enough and find it important enough to talk about some of those nutritional strategies. And we would probably do it whether we had a candy bar or a bowl of oatmeal for breakfast. And so the same applies to smoking. This is important enough that we have to be willing to talk about it. And so that staff who is a smoker who's feeling that resistance might not be the one who wants to run the groups, but if you can relay the information and share the information and have that open and frank discussion about why this is so important and how, you know, being open and honest either about their personal struggles with tobacco or at least about sharing information and providing a referral to another staff member, at least putting it on the table, can really move somebody towards quitting and can really have a wonderful impact on their health and their life, then it can help you to kind of overcome some of that resistance. As far as that relates to policy, as I mentioned, we did we made our policy changes in stages. And one of the first parts of the policy that we agreed on was that none of our staff, including our peer staff, were going to smoke with our clients. So smoking was still permitted on the grounds. It was still permitted for staff and for consumers, although most of our staff who were smokers at that time didn't smoke while they were on the grounds at work. but we decided that we didn't want to encourage and we didn't want to keep smoking as part of the therapeutic relationship, and so we asked that all staff remove it from the relationships that they have with their clients. And for some of the staff, especially in our case management program, this was kind of difficult because when they needed to address something significant or they needed to simply engage a client, a lot of times they'd be like, let's go outside and have a cigarette together. And that was an opportunity to talk. That was like an in with the client. But it was important to remove that. And I think for our staff who were smokers, that was a change that they were able to make that they felt comfortable with that allowed them to take that first step into being a part of this process and a part of this new community and this new culture that really supported health over smoking.
Our next question is from Dan Celery Hammerstead. Dan, please state your question.
Hi, thanks. In your experience, has there been any, can you generalize about what has helped people move to a more readiness place?
Well, in my experience, it's been really getting somebody ready to make a change, like quitting smoking, has really come down to three things. One, it's about knowledge, so making sure that they have access to knowledge, to information about tobacco, but not beating them over the heads with it. Most people know that smoking causes cancer, so it has to be more personalized knowledge, how it's impacting their life or information that they might not have known otherwise, something that kind of piques their interest. The other thing is skill development, so preparing them to make these changes. So like I said, instead of focusing on quitting smoking, focusing on increasing their skills for managing stress or increasing their skills for managing conflict instead of turning to a cigarette or socialization so that they felt prepared, they felt stronger when they finally got that motivation. And then the third thing is the consistency of the message, and that goes back to that one slide where I mentioned talking about tobacco and why it really has to be consistent. They have to be hearing from, you know, the person who's serving them lunch and the peer specialist that they're sitting with in the afternoon and in their groups and from their advisor or their therapist and their psychiatrist or nurse practitioner. They have to be hearing from everybody that this is important and it's something that we talk about, because if it's important to us and they know that we care about them and it becomes part of that therapeutic relationship, it will allow it to be important to them as well, even though it's something that's scary and overwhelming and they might not feel like they're ready for or might not feel like they can do, it will become important.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Robert Oppenheim. Robert, please state your question or comment.
Hello, Amanda. This is Faith Oviatt. Bob had to step out, but I wanted to ask you, do you have a telephone number where I could call and ask for a couple of these manuals to be sent to our agency?
I can give you my telephone number where
Great.
You can, I can definitely send you some more information. It's area code
631-471-7242.
And my extension is 13-4-3-4-7.
Okay, Amanda, mm-hmm. Then I will call you and put an order in, okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Lisa Marini. Lisa, please state your question or comment.
Hi. First, I just wanted to say this was an excellent presentation. Thank you so much for your time and effort on this. It was really helpful.
Thank you.
My question is around the nicotine replacement therapy. You did a lot of great slides. This data is tremendously helpful. Thank you for sharing it. I didn't know if you had anything that you would be interested in adding about maybe either consistent barriers that you found with specifically with the population you work with,
mm-hmm.
around using NRT, or just highlighting areas of education points with medication usage that you thought were particularly important with the group you're working with?
Well, actually, what we found and what we ended up focusing a lot on in the NRT chapter of our group was the proper use of nicotine replacement therapy, because we found that the common barriers to the NRT was getting a prescription so that it would be covered by Medicaid or finding access to free resources for it. So that they would often be able to get first a starter dose through the quit line, but then in order to maintain it longer term, they needed to get a prescription from their doctors, and we got a lot of resistance. So it was, you know, the primary care physician saying the psychiatrist should be prescribing and vice versa. So we, to overcome that, we did education with the consumer about what the different types were, how they worked, had them identify what they thought they would like to use, and then we have a letter that they filled out and checked off what they wanted to use and brought it with them to their doctor's office that also had the contact number of the facilitator of the group so that the office could call and clarify. And then we did a lot of work around how do you actually use these NRTs, because unfortunately, when our clients were able to get their hands on them, they weren't always using them properly. So the gum, they were chewing like chewing gum or swallowing it. The inhaler, they were not replacing the cartridges, or, you know, they would only puff on it for a couple of minutes and then put it away for the day. The nasal spray they seemed to use correctly, although there was a lot of discontinuing use of it. So we did a lot of preparation around what to expect the first time you use it and what the side effects are and how those will stop if you use it continuously and consistently. So a lot of it was really around, you know, how these medications work and how you have to use them so that you get the effect of them. The other thing that we made sure to include, which is important information for all providers as well as for the members, was the realistic expectations for these medications. So we know that, you know, popping a piece of nicotine gum in your mouth is not going to feel the same as puffing on a cigarette. And so we did a lot of education and preparation when somebody was getting ready to use an NRT about what is this going to feel like? And how it's going to be helpful, but it's not going to be the same, and, you know, what other tools they need to use so that they can overcome that craving for a cigarette and still be successful. So those were the things that we addressed.
So just to follow up, it sounds like you really just have to go through the very practical, very detailed explanation that you might not have to go through as much with someone with that doesn't have a serious mental health issue, and that you just have to spend a lot more time and taking more time with that person. That's what I'm sort of
right, or in the group about educating. Like when we teach about the nicotine gum, it's not just teaching about, you know, how it works in the body, like biophysically, but it really about how do you chew it. You know, where do you put it in your mouth? When we have the resources to do so, a lot of times we would bring in samples of the over-the-counter medications and have people try it. You know, try a piece of nicotine gum. What does it taste like? How do you use it? You know, are you getting any of the side effects? How can you help to avoid, like, the nausea and heartburn? If you're not chewing as much and not swallowing as much, you don't get as much of the nausea and heartburn. So how to avoid some of those symptoms.
Well, thank you, and I think it's wonderful that you went through so many steps to make sure that the clients got that, especially helping with something to bring to their doctor. So I think that's wonderful. Thanks.
Thanks.
Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, as a reminder, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
So if anybody is interested in either getting a copy of the smoke alarm video or in getting any of the materials that I've talked about or referenced today, again, I gave out my phone number, but I'll give you it again. It's area code 631-471-7242, extension 1347, or you can email me at Tara, T-A-R-A, Fredericks, Fredericks, at Clubhouse of Suffolk, C-L-U-B-H-O-U-S-E-O-F, susfolk.org. And I'd be happy to send along any materials or answer any questions that you might not have thought of while we're on this call.
We have a last-minute question from Lisa Marini. And did you want to take it? Yes. Lisa, please state your question.
Sorry, I'm sorry about that. In the group setting, I know we heard a little bit last call from Dr. Williams about how positive situations can help other, increase the success across the group. And I wanted to see if you saw that specifically with NRT, but also my concerns that if something wasn't going well, how did you manage situations where someone had a setback?
Okay. Well, with regards to NRTs, we definitely saw, as some of our group members started to use them and have positive effects, that they would talk about it in the group. And again, I mentioned we encouraged them to use their nicotine replacement therapy in group if that was, a reasonable time for them to be using it, not just in our smoking group, but in all of our groups. So seeing another member and they'd be like, oh, you're trying the inhaler, what do you think? And they were able to kind of share their experiences. As far as negative experiences, one of the things that we teach right from the start when we're talking about the stages of change in our Why I Smoke group is that relapse is a part of this. And so we treat any relapse or lapse or kind of setback as an opportunity to learn about what worked, what didn't work, what skills do you need, what supports do you need, or what could you do next time if something like this happens again. And so the group can be really powerful in that way. They were able to, instead of taking it and saying, oh, well, see, she wasn't successful, so I probably won't be either, they were really able to offer each other feedback and give support and kind of be a resource. And I think that the experience of both success and setbacks from group members is all really powerful. And it can teach the group. So somebody might say, oh, you were triggered by, you were hanging out with your friends. Well, then maybe I need to be prepared because I'm thinking about going out with my friend this weekend and she's a smoker. So what can I do?
Lisa, your line is still unmuted.
Oh, I just want to say thank you for that. That was helpful to hear. I appreciate
it. Okay.
It appears we have no further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for the opportunity. And again, please feel free to contact me if you think of anything or would like any additional information.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation, and all participants may disconnect their line at this time.
Are we back in the subgroup?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
Actually, I'm glad we're getting done.